Coming up today, we find out why being forgetful could actually be a good thing. We talk bank accounts that know you off by heart, quite literally. And we find out the true extent of GCHQ's hacking again. All that and more coming up. This is the wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to Ebola prep and biometric banking. I'm your host, Liat Clark, and I'm associate editor of wired.co.uk.
I'm Katie Collins.
And I'm James Templeton.
Lovely, guys. All here to talk about Ebola and GCHQ. What could be better to do on a Thursday?
I can't think of anything, personally.
But you did something much better last night, right?
Oh, I did. So I went to the Game of Thrones world premiere last night of season five. And I got to see not only the first episode of the new season, which I will be writing about later today, but I got to see lots of the cast, including the wonderful Charles Dance and the handsome Kit Harington.
In the flesh.
Yes.
And they had it somewhere pretty cool as well.
Yeah, it was probably the perfect location for a Game of Thrones premiere. It was at the Tower of London, which is obviously, it's got a great gruesome history to
it.
Yeah,
nice, very gothic.
Yeah, very Game of Thrones-esque. So yeah, that was really, really fun evening.
Excellent. But I hear there was a barrier between you and the real celebs.
Yes, we were allowed to walk the red carpet, but not touch any of the celebrities.
Not famous yet.
No.
Sad times.
Not yet.
You can touch me, Katie.
Thanks, Liat.
No problem. Well, you can read Katie's review if you just search Game of Thrones on the website. But that's all for now. Let's get on with the news. So, Katie, Bill Gates and Melinda Gates, in fact, as of part of the foundation, have released some interesting documents on Ebola.
That's right. So Bill Gates is really quite well known for his work, his philanthropic work in disease and helping with public health care in poorer countries. But he rarely actually gets involved in making kind of policy suggestions. That's all changed now because he, following the Ebola outbreak, he decided that the time had come to actually kind of get more involved in the politics of healthcare, and he's released a paper which is called The Next Epidemic, and it basically reflects on the Ebola outbreak that we just had and looks at what we will need to do to prepare for the next major epidemic, which could be way worse than Ebola.
And he reckons it's going to be some sort of flu.
Yes, well, I mean, it could be anything. We don't know what the next outbreak is, but one thing that he pointed out, which I hadn't really thought of at all, was that Ebola isn't actually that infectious. It requires kind of bodily contact, but it's quite likely that if there is another epidemic of a disease, it will be airborne, which means that the infection rate will be much, much higher. And flu is probably the primary candidate. And it could be, you know, it could be a different version of flu that we haven't seen before.
And we've had these types of outbreaks before where there's just like panic with SARS when
exactly.
That happened, and they've been talking for years about, yes, you know, different types of bird flu that might evolve to be airborne, and then we're all in trouble.
So what does he reckon we should be doing?
So he's made a kind of a whole list of recommendations, and they kind of come under a number of different categories. So looking at how we can improve primary healthcare systems, how we can improve disease surveillance, so, you know, kind of basically mapping outbreaks and noticing and you know, making sure that basically we're on top of where disease might be spreading.
But it's kind of noticing the first point of care, making sure the first point of care is spot on.
Yes, yeah. And also medical tools. So that would be firstly diagnostic tools, also vaccines and the kind of the therapeutic drugs as well to treat whatever the outbreak is. And he also talked a little bit about how all of this could come under a kind of a greater policy for bioterrorism as well, because potentially an outbreak could be, it could be a natural outbreak, as you know, as we've seen in the past, or it could be bioterrorism. But either way, the same kind of recommendations apply.
So he still thinks it should be treated as if it's war.
Yeah, so this is one thing that he said that basically it really kind of hit home in terms of if we do have a massive outbreak, the kind of the effect of it. I mean, it could kill. It could easily kill more people than any kind of given war that we've had so far. And obviously, with any epidemic and any outbreak, the military does need to be involved to a certain extent as well. In terms of resources like transportation and communication and also personnel and that kind of thing. So and he believes that while we do spend, he doesn't kind of criticize the amount of money that countries spend on preparing for war, but he does say that we should treat the potential for an epidemic with the same kind of seriousness as we treat kind of our readiness for war.
Well, and he's writing from the US perspective, where they spend an unbelievable amount on defense each year.
Exactly.
Each year.
And you know, he does have quite a global perspective. I will say that for him. You know, he does reference lots of different countries in the various work that they're doing in this report. But he kind of says that what we should all do is each country should kind of commit to this, to building a global response and warning system.
I was going to say, because an awful lot of the recommendations that you've talked about thus far are kind of obvious things that we should be doing.
It's
like, have great first point of care, have vaccines, have all these things that we know that we should have in place.
Mm.
But I'm guessing he wants a bigger overview in place.
Yeah, so he wants us to prepare the military for outbreaks like this. And he also thinks that we should have a trained set of responders. So, the UK and the US were really great at, and lots of other countries as well, I think China as well, sending out people to West Africa during the Ebola outbreak.
The UK did send military, I believe.
Yeah.
As well. I don't know if the US did.
But, a lot of the volunteers that went out there to actually help with the healthcare problems, you know, there were all sorts of problems in terms of, you know, insuring them, making sure that they had evacuation plans in place, making sure that they were properly compensated, and also making sure, apparently it's quite common for volunteers to face discrimination when they come back home.
Yeah.
And, you know, they might not necessarily be able to keep their jobs and that kind of thing. But the idea is to have all that set up beforehand, to have trained responders, to have kind of these exercises. So the same way that they do it in the military, you know, have these practice exercises. And know exactly what the resources are that you'll be able to allocate.
Because that's what the military are trained to do day by day. And
exactly.
It is, like we saw with Ebola, it's a logistical nightmare. And in terms of you can't close all transport routes to stop the spread.
It's very weird this coming from the guy who founded Microsoft. I mean, I know he's done so much work on disease over the year, but is it really his place to be making these policy suggestions?
Well, I mean, what he's done is he's spoken to experts in different fields to put this report together. So he's kind of gathered his expertise. And I suppose, you know, he's put himself in a position now where he's been doing so much work through his foundation. And he does have a really in-depth understanding of vaccines and the way that, and the effect that, you know, developing better vaccines can, you know, play in healthcare in poorer countries, that I think he's kind of put himself in the position now where it would almost be irresponsible of him not to speak out. And you know, he's not a scientist, he's not a researcher, but, you know, he is a voice of authority.
And people are going to sit up and pay attention, you think?
I definitely think they will. And you know, it is really important. It's difficult because, as he points out in his paper, like, it's really difficult to pinpoint whose responsibility it is to pull all this together. That people presume that it's the United Nations, but they don't necessarily deal with this kind of thing. Or people presume it's the World Health Organization, but they don't necessarily have the resources.
And the issue with an outbreak like Ebola, I think we've seen, is that communities that are impacted, there's obviously a lot of fear and a lot of paranoia within communities, but also towards outsiders coming in.
Yes.
Whereas if countries were equipped, their own military could handle it. Because again, if you throw in the word military, it's quite scary if your villages and towns are suddenly taken over by the military. If it's not done properly and the communication isn't there.
Well,
so to have that kind of consensus. And with Bill Gates talking about it, I kind of think, you know, big charities, Red Cross and all sorts, would make kind of these kinds of recommendations and reports. And he's just another person doing it who has probably got decades of experience.
And a lot of money.
And a lot of money, yes. Yeah. And a figure of authority, like you say. So.
Yeah. So, yeah, hopefully, you know, governments will take this into account and will start looking at how that they can prepare for this kind of thing in the future, and we'll look at money and how much they're going to allocate to something like this. But I think it's a really good point. It's a really great time to discuss it following Ebola, and we should think about this now, and hopefully governments will take this into account.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure Katie will keep track of this story. So
I will.
Check out her current one out on the website. If you search for Ebola, you can see all our coverage from the past year or so. James, this is quite an exciting time for fans of Donkey Kong, I believe.
And Mario and Link and all the other Nintendo characters.
So because they're heading to smartphones.
They are. Now, do you guys play games on your phones?
Mm. Yeah, I am definitely, yeah, I play rubbish games, but I'm definitely a phone gamer.
Mm-hmm. Mm. But you maybe only spend like 20 minutes at a time, you dip in and out of it, you don't spend hours at once looking at a game.
Yeah, it's like a thing I do on my commute.
I do it until I reach my data limit.
Right, yes. So Nintendo has long said that it isn't going to do smartphone games because it's above all that and it's got its own consoles where it thinks it can make more money. But now it's decided that actually that's completely wrong and that it does want to make smartphone games because it can make more money.
Amazing.
Which is good news if you like good games, because Nintendo, much as it's criticised, does make very good games.
Yeah, I have such fond memories of Mario.
Exactly.
Mario Kart.
I think people of our sort of age that grew up in the 80s and the 90s really, really loved Nintendo. It was probably a big part of a lot of people's childhoods. So the company has said that the games won't be ports of existing titles, but will be completely new game experiences.
Even better.
And that all of its top intellectual property will be up for grabs. So we're not going to see some random games. We're going to see Mario games and Zelda games and Donkey Kong games, which is pretty exciting. We're going to see the first one before the end of this year. We don't know whether
Amazing.
That will just be in Japan or around the world, but eventually this is going to be something that it will do all over the world. And it's partnered up with a mobile game development expert called DNA. It's a big Japanese company. And they're going to hopefully start producing lots of really good games.
This could be huge. It's quite exciting, really, because you think there are so many games out there that I always spend time looking at top 10s and top 20s of particular
Invariably,
types of genres
populated
I like.
By nonsense.
Yeah, there's so
very
much
very difficult to find good games,
and you have to pay for a lot of, you either have to pay for a lot of them or you have annoying adverts or whatever it is, or you have to buy extra things to break through to the next level. But if it was a Mario game, I don't think we're going to shed many tears about paying a small amount for it.
I was going to say that if there was a Mario game available, I would happily pay for it.
Yeah, you wouldn't be conflicted. You wouldn't be like me there sitting reading five sites about their top 100 games and action adventure.
It's difficult to cut through the nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah, very.
Yeah.
So Nintendo, well, they've basically sold us on the name. They could be total rubbish, the games, but we're all going to...
They might well be total rubbish. And what they definitely won't be is big Nintendo Epic games that you see on the consoles. They said that its premium experiences are still going to be reserved for its own consoles, for handheld and home consoles. And the stuff that it makes for smartphones and tablets will be smaller games that are more suitable for the format. Whether that will be freemium games where you annoyingly have to pay to unlock more levels or more features, or whether you'll have to pay for the games to begin with, but they'll be quite small.
I want a full game.
Seen.
Yeah,
Nintendo
DS,
who play Zelda, and it's a full game.
Yeah,
small.
Yeah.
I was going to ask actually about that, whether you knew about freemium or whether, you know, which model it's going to follow.
So the company that they partnered with, DNA, are well known in Japan for freemium games.
Oh, I don't
want
to play a
freemium
game.
And for the kind of mobile games that maybe turn people off a little bit.
Okay.
But Nintendo comes at it from a very different perspective. Mm. And it's a proper partnership. Both of them are taken multi-million pound stakes in each other, so they're in this for the long haul, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out of it. But Nintendo don't tend to make bad games.
No,
exactly. Please write in, let us know if you're going to pay for this or you would actually want the freemium model. I would not. I don't like paying $2.99 for coins. So for the first time in the history of this planet, neuroscientists have observed that recalling certain memories day to day causes us to forget other similar memories. We're doing a little mental jigsaw where we're shoving other memories out to the back somewhere and forgetting them.
And they can see this in people's brains.
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't look like a magical Tetris-style jigsaw of brain neurons. No, but they can see it. They can. They've seen it happen for the first time.
So what does it look like? Do you know what it looks like?
It's kind of squishy and there's electrical impulses.
Okay.
I don't know what it looks like, but the University of Birmingham does. I think this is something that people have long thought about, like, oh, I can't fit any more in my brain. Oh, one more thing and it's, you know, stuff's going to come out the back. We have nice mental images of things falling out of our ears. I do anyway. but they've actually, you know, proven that this is kind of the case. This team from Birmingham performed a number of what they called boring tasks, looking at pictures of Marilyn Monroe and Albert Einstein, which I think sounds thrilling. And they would have to do this over and over again. And be taught to associate them with particular cue words or other types of cues. Then they recorded the brain's responses each time the subjects would see the images. Then they asked the subjects to kind of try and trigger both memories, but using only one cue word. But they would say they would ask them actually to recall one image. So they'd be using a cue word that would bridge both these images.
Right.
But say, can you just tell us one image? What they found more often than not was that the first image that they had been shown was the one that they always recalled, not the second one.
So it nudged the other one out the way.
Nudged the other one out of the way, because then, you know, subsequent requests from the researchers would find that they were always more likely to give the response they had initially given to
so
the researchers.
So we're deliberately forgetful rather than just doing it by accident.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So it's like the brain has made a choice. Oh, I've remembered this first one. That's the most important. Hold on to that. They might ask you again. Oh, look, they've asked me again. That's the image. Or that's my interpretation.
So the idea is that because it's something more significant, even if it's just an image of Marilyn Monroe over an image of Albert Einstein, that we'll remember the Monroe image because we see it as more significant because we've seen it more often.
You've seen it more often. You've been asked about it again. Like the fact that you've recalled it once is reinforced the next time you are asked. So you're kind of signifying that as more important and trying to get rid of information that's detracting. They only want you to recall one image. So I only need to remember one image.
So is this why I always forget people's names when I first meet them?
Well, you can use that excuse now if you like.
I think I will.
Just email this.
My brain is being efficient.
Over. I think, my husband's going to have great fun when he... I'm not going to send this to him ever because I just think he doesn't listen, but he thinks he has a bad memory. Anyway, the researcher Maria Wimber behind it pointed out that we've always thought that we're passively forgetting things because of horrible things like deterioration, but this kind of puts us back in the driver's seat and says, no, we've got a sense of agency here. Our brains are actually really amazing and they're just trying to help us out. She said our research reveals that people are more engaged than they realize in shaping what they remember of their lives. The brain seems to think that things we use frequently are the things that are really valuable to us, so it just makes sure that you get, you know, you keep the important stuff, get rid of all the distractions. Which I think is interesting. And they've proposed some really novel applications, which I imagine are many years away. But for things like PTSD, where perhaps you know, the brain has functions where you kind of forget, you can forget traumatic things. Some people can't, to be able to cope and move forward. And I'm not sure quite how they could use this knowledge.
But it gives them a new understanding of how memory works, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's a very long way down the road for how they could actually use this type of thing in therapy. But they're hoping, and again, equally, you know, disorders like, well, Alzheimer's, dementia, kind of in an overarching way, it would help us understand what's happening to people and potentially can we stem that.
It goes without saying that brains are very clever.
Yes. Really clever, which also makes them really hard to understand.
Yeah, but it's fascinating.
But we have them, so
we
should be able to.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this idea that we might be able to kind of reprogram our ability to remember things by understanding this. We have the potential to use it and manipulate it.
Unless we
advantage.
Turn our brains to mush, which is what Magic Leap founder thinks we're going to do when we all use virtual reality headsets.
Never.
That's not a direct quote. That's a fast exaggeration of what he said. So Katie, Halifax has gone all sexy.
It has. I mean, you don't necessarily think of it as like, you know, particularly sexy bank, do you?
No.
Halifax.
But most banks aren't.
No.
If you consider biometric technology sexy...
Yeah. Well,
it is.
Yes. So Halifax has basically been experimenting with ECG technology. So that's electrocardiograms that looks at the unique rhythm of the heartbeat. And what it's hoping is that perhaps ECG signals could replace online banking passwords.
This is different to someone's pulse, or it is someone's pulse?
No, this is different to pulse.
So it's like a unique signal rather than just dum dum.
Yes.
Dum, dum.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, a little bit like our fingerprint. It's unique to us, but it's more secure than our fingerprint.
It's like the fingerprint of your heart.
Exactly. Because obviously, unlike a fingerprint, which is kind of is kind of a tangible physical thing that you could potentially replicate, they think it's going to be really, really hard to replicate your kind of your password to
your rhythm.
Your
the password
rhythm.
To your heart.
This
yes.
all sounds terribly, terribly corny.
Well, in fact, it's got a very practical application.
At Halifax.
Halifax have been doing this trial where they've been experimenting with this, looking at how you can use it to log into online banking services. And what it's been doing is it's been using technology that's called a NIMI band or a NIMI band.
NIMI, maybe.
NIMI. And this uses Bluetooth to pair with a companion app for kind of various different operating systems. And it what it does is it records your ECG on the band and links to the app. And the data is captured when you wear the band on one wrist and touch a sensor on the top of the band with your opposite finger. And this kind of all it kind of works in like a closed security loop type thing.
So you have to be wearing the band to get into the app, which yeah. lets you do your banking.
Yeah, but so you have to be well, it sounds like it initially. I mean, the technology behind it is, you know, not, you know, it's quite kind of complex technology, but as a user it could be very simple. You know, you need, rather than kind of inputting passwords and things to
you
every
just
time,
touch a band on your wrist yeah. for a couple of seconds.
And it needs to be near your phone, obviously. It won't, you know, you won't be able to do this without kind of having your finger, your heartbeat, your phone nearby. So it's kind of all these things coming together to create a very kind of secure system.
I feel like we're going to have to fast forward to the days when it's just embedded under our flesh.
Yes, that is going to be the next step.
Yeah, because everyone's going to lose their band. James is frowning, but it will happen.
See, I use a silly little band to get around the tube and the buses in London.
Oh, do you?
And I don't always lose it, but I always leave it on tables
yeah,
when I walk
nightmare.
Out of places.
That's, yeah. It's so
it's
annoying.
It's only the same as losing a bank card or an Oyster
yeah,
card.
Yeah, really annoying.
Yeah, it's another thing to lose, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, whereas, you know.
But yeah, no, I mean, and this technology itself is still proof of concept. You know, it's not that Halifax isn't going to be rolling this out to customers in the immediate future, but it is looking at this and kind of other similar technology that could potentially be used to improve our banking security. So whether that's...
Anything's got to be good if it stops people from using terrible passwords.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we talked a little bit about this, I think, last week when we were talking about the FIDO Alliance Security Protocol. But basically, we are verging on the death of the password.
Maybe.
Well, you know,
these things die slowly.
They do. And, you know, it takes time to reprogram people's kind of expectations and behavior as well as users.
Especially when there's so many disparate solutions that people are proposing.
Yes.
That's people
yeah.
aren't going to feel comfortable when there's so many different things out there. You want to know that this is the definitive thing,
yeah.
which I know, it, you know, obviously that's not ideal. You want to have lots of different methods because then it makes it harder to crack. But consumers, you know, you want to feel like they're using yeah. something tried and tested by millions.
Well, the idea behind the FIDO protocol is that it's that is the security protocol behind it, and it can be attached to anything, any different kind of biometric authenticator. So that could be this wrist technology, or it could be iris scanning, or it could be, but like the kind of the security protocol behind it is the one that is already being used by banks actually and by companies like Google, and it's like the idea is that it doesn't matter what you use at the front end to assert your presence, the back end bit is secure.
No, very interesting. If you are a Halifax customer and would actually use this, or you're just waiting for the day that someone can insert it under your flesh, maybe in your wrist, maybe in your finger, please write in and let us know. Podcast@wired.co.uk. that's all the news this week. But still to come, we're going to discuss yet more terrifying reveals about GCHQ's hacking capabilities. Surprise, surprise.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
So, Leah, you said terrifying reveals about GCHQ, or you could say reassuring.
Are they reassuring?
Well, we know more than we used to know.
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power,
yeah,
etc.
Although, as it just made us feel even more powerless to what
they're
doing. Well,
let's try and make our minds up. So, three new documents have given us details of what GCHQ might be doing.
Okay.
Without getting too long-winded, these are the Intelligence and Security Committee's report into the UK's spy agencies, GCHQ and the government's response, and a new draft equipment interference code, which is used to ensure that everything is done legally, with oversight, and within the boundaries of sense.
Well, that sounds great. That sounds like we're all sorted.
Sounds like it, doesn't it?
So we now know an awful lot more.
Well, they've got oversight.
Yes,
done.
They do. And they said they do. So, but there are concerns. Okay. So what we found out for the first time is that GCHQ does do hacking, which we knew from Snowden anyway, but now it's actually come from the horse's mouth. And that's always nice. So the spy agency has confirmed it. And it's also confirmed that it's doing lots of stuff to break encryption. We kind of knew this from the allegations that GCHQ hacked the SIM card maker Gemalto and the Belgian telecoms giant Belgacom. Hmm. But now it's come out in a government document, so it's confirmed. Not those specific operations, but its ability to do those sort of things. So privacy organisations have claimed that these papers suggest that GCHQ has the ability to hack anyone, anywhere, at any time, which is concerning. And they've also claimed that there's very little oversight. GCHQ, as it has done from day one, argues that all its operations are lawful, proportionate, and subject to rigorous oversight.
So how are they lawful? If I mean, it sounds all really unwieldy, but what justification are they using?
So this is more an issue of the law being an arse than GCHQ being one.
Okay. Mm. Oh, well, not GCHQ's fault then, really.
Well, there are issues with GCHQ as well, but let's deal with it step by step. So in the UK, GCHQ's hacking operations fall under what's known as Section 5 of the 1994 Intelligence Services Act. This allows spy agencies to do illegal things without breaking the law. Now, the Computer Misuse Act in the UK means it's illegal to hack people, but this Section 5 order means that GCHQ can hack people so long as it gets a warrant. But there are vagaries in this system. Mm. And part of the problem is, and when you ask GCHQ questions about this, as we have done, is that they won't say what they're doing because it's top secret.
But it says they have to have a warrant. Someone has to
yes.
be
so
signing
a warrant,
this off.
A warrant signed off by the Home Secretary has to be given. But there are vagaries. GCHQ seemingly doesn't need to provide exact details of who it wants to hack or surveil. So phrases such as only where known, as in the person, and where relevant, as in the specific details, crop up in official documents.
What, in the wording of how
In the wording of how it operates and how it defines its operations. So GCHQ could, depending on your interpretation, get permission for broad hacking operations rather than just going after specific targets.
So are we
but
talking
it would still have
mass
a warrant for them.
Or are we talking
Well, we don't know.
A bunch of people.
It's not clear, but that's the problem with what we're finding out about the legislation that GCHQ operates under, that it doesn't, it's so opaque and it's so broad that there's no way of understanding if it is actually being very good or if it's being quite bad. Something else that's quite interesting is GCHQ has been criticised for its poor record keeping. So the ISC report, which was looking at all of the UK's intelligence agencies, found that GCHQ wasn't keeping very good records of its hacking operations.
Was and they it said, actually allowed to see them? It's probably not allowed to see the full records.
I'm sure they gave an idea of what they were doing in order to audit themselves internally. And it was fairly obvious that they weren't doing a terrifically good job. Oh. And the ISC said, you've got to keep good records. You can't be doing these sort of things and not keeping records.
It's the basis of any business, government, department, just life.
And again, privacy advocates have pointed out that you've got to have good records if you're going to have good oversight. The whole system falls apart if someone isn't keeping an eye on what everyone is doing.
So why do you think they're not keeping good records? Number one, because they're doing illegal things that they don't want a record of. Or number two, they've not been commanded to, so they're not.
again, it's completely impossible to tell because it's so opaque. But there's certainly an issue here. Good records do need to be kept. And GCHQ will always maintain that it is operating within the law. But as I said earlier, it might just be that the law is completely useless and that GCHQ is doing what it should do, but it shouldn't be allowed to do that in the first place, if you get me.
So what other terrifying bits, nuggets, have we garnered?
All right, so we talked about inside the UK. Let's talk about outside the UK. So outside the UK, GCHQ's hacking operations, bit of a mouthful, are authorised by Section 7 of the 1994 Intelligence Services Act. Now, there are five what are known as broad class-based authorisations that GCHQ uses for its hacking work outside the UK. Now, we don't quite understand how these class-based authorisations work, but essentially GCHQ doesn't need specific warrants to do its operations outside the UK. It just uses these five broad permissions, if you like.
Okay.
Now, once again, these privacy advocates, basically I've spoken to Privacy International, the Open Rights Group, and we've also spoken to university professors with experts in cybersecurity and privacy, and they reckon that this allows GCHQ to hack targets with very little oversight at all and with no specific ministerial authorization.
Is the argument here with them, you know, if it's UK citizens on UK home turf, we're all over it with oversight. We know what we're doing, and the laws are covering
it. There is definitely oversight.
But abroad, we just are not required to deliver the same kind of oversight. Do you think there's more oversight for our citizens than in this country?
It feels a little bit like the law, they've kind of had to set up the law so that the citizens of this country are to some extent protected. But
because it is operating in this country's best interests.
Yes, exactly. And the law should protect people within this country, but
yes,
that they just kind of, I don't know why, have they not got round to thinking about people abroad?
But it's exactly the same for the NSA. So Americans are very, very well protected, or well enough protected by laws governing the NSA. But when it wants to go after someone outside of the United States of America, it pretty much has carte blanche to do whatever it wants.
Hence the Five Eyes Alliance. This is the whole point of what's come out.
And then
the
you get problems with intelligence sharing and all this sort of thing.
We share this information so that if we want to find out about Katie's life, we just need to ask America.
Go and spy on her.
Yeah.
So the documents we've had over the last couple of weeks reveal that GCHQ's overseas hacking and indeed its efforts to break encryption protocols to essentially weaken the security of the internet and allow it to do all sorts of things are afforded to it under a general power given to GCHQ with, quote, no additional ministerial authorization unless there is significant economic or political risk. Now, we have no idea how these broad class-based authorizations are being used, and GCHQ won't tell us about it because it's top secret. But once again, the agency argues that its actions are lawful and subject to rigorous oversight.
Well, yes. I mean, GCHQ got in touch with you, didn't they? And they basically just pointed you towards...
They pointed us towards the specific sections of the 1994 Intelligence Services Act and also the draft code that they're using at the moment that was brought out in February, which is what they're using to conduct their surveillance and hacking operations now.
But obviously they won't be drawn on specifics, which apparently includes how one applies these laws in real life.
So what are the specific concerns about this? So there could be an issue of collateral damage. So the documents seem to suggest that GCHQ can go after innocent people to get to specific targets. So, for example, Liat, they could hack your email accounts to get to a terrorist target. You would be essentially a bit of collateral damage on the way to that terrorist target. But they wouldn't see it as collateral. They would see it as they need to get to that target, and you're part of the warrant to get to that target.
Well, if I've been talking to terrorists, does that not make it legal?
But you might not have been talking to terrorists about terrorism.
Yes.
You could just be
they won't
innocent...
know until they read my emails.
Exactly. So
they either ask me about it.
What it seems to suggest is that the warrants and the permissions are quite vague and that it doesn't need to get specific permission to go after specific targets. And we got a bit of an inkling of this because it's been alleged to hack major companies in order to break encryption tools, Gemalto and Belgacom again. So that is something. Again, GCHQ won't be specific about what it's doing, so we can't say.
But they could, if they had good reason to believe that I was communicating with terrorists.
But not about terrorist stuff.
But they don't stipulate whether they have to know that or not. So they might have to know it. They might have to tell the Home Secretary.
It seems that they don't. It seems, and again, this is an interpretation of the documents, that GCHQ can go through someone else or a company to get to a specific target. So it doesn't have to be directed absolutely at the target that they're going for.
Okay.
Which is interesting.
So I take it that the politicians that are kind of signing off these warrants and issuing these warrants, have they kind of never thought to kind of question this, or do they not? What is it? Do they not know enough about the, you know, how the agencies operate? Do they just kind of just say, oh, yes, I'll just sign that off. That looks about right. I'll, you know, do they not question things?
Well, according to GCHQ itself, and I will paraphrase a little bit here, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, or FCO, whose remit GCHQ and other intelligence agencies fall under, doesn't understand what spy agencies are doing. They don't have that.
Right.
I think the phrase was technical understanding to be able to get a full grasp of some of the things that GCHQ does. And obviously these are incredibly high-tech operations,
yeah,
going after encryption and breaking into people's email accounts and into companies. Very, very difficult to do. Very impressive technical knowledge. And to expect ministers who don't really have any sort of technical understanding to get that is, I think, naive, but it shows a problem with the oversight of everything that our spy agencies do, and indeed everything that a country or the world does. You can't necessarily expect ministers to know in depth what it's about.
Yeah, which is kind of concerning in one way, because so much of, you know, of the political, you know, kind of landscape is online these days, and, you know, there's so much is riding on this.
But that's been a kind of, well, it's probably not been a slow progression, but for them it's been a slow progression catching up. And that's why,
yes,
I mean, there's been arguments for many years about, you know, having everyone in government having certain expertise, and why aren't we voting in people with this background? Or then we have, you know, the Lords, we might have people like Martha Lane Fox who have this expertise, who can be consulted.
Yeah.
And in this instance, we do have the Intelligence and Security Committee.
Yes.
I'm assuming that's kind of...
They did have a really,
only...
really broad panel of experts.
Yeah.
They called on a lot of people with a lot of knowledge of this sort of area to talk them through it and to try and help them understand it and to provide lots and lots of different perspectives. And that's something that we haven't had before. Had Edward Snowden not done what he did, then we wouldn't be having this open and public debate about surveillance laws. And whether you think surveillance is a good thing or a bad thing, it should be something that we make an active decision in, rather than simply allowing it to happen without any sort of debate.
Of course.
So the privacy organisations that James was referred to before have kind of criticised the Intelligence Security Committee report, because it's only just happened. Like, the committee is in place to oversee the actions of not only GCHQ but MI5 and MI6 as well. And the only reason that this report has even come about, the only reason that they even kind of got off their asses and like wrote the report in the first place, is because Edward Snowden brought all this information to light. Like, it shouldn't take Edward Snowden coming forward to instigate this kind of, you know, oversight and them doing their job.
To a certain extent, I'm guessing, well, this is just a guess, that the argument being these checks and balances and reports were in place, they just weren't publicly known about because we are dealing with security issues. So
it's perfectly possible
that ministers have been, you know, privy to this oversight. It's just not something, now that Snowden has come out, we want it to be public.
But even at the moment, GCHQ is operating under a draft code of practice. It's not primary legislation, so it hasn't been voted on in Parliament. And
but that's because we found out that everything is illegal.
Yes.
And we had to have new
It's got draft legislation, and for it to be carrying out all of its operations under that is a little bit dubious. And something else that's worth remembering is the US was a lot quicker to react to the Snowden revelations. It's been over 2 years, I think, now, since he appeared in that hotel room in Hong Kong. And this is the first really, really solid government-led action against it.
It is quite, to play devil's advocate, I think it is quite a mammoth task to do it.
Certainly.
In a way that's not only safe and not putting anyone in danger, but in a way that is going to keep people happy that they are able to, you know, investigate in depth enough and deliver the information that we need to know and that we want. That's a vast exercise that will take tons of, you know, legal experts.
Yeah.
and
it's worth
consultation
doing properly
with an organization that doesn't want to talk to anyone, that doesn't want to share information.
Yeah, and this is maybe the only time we're going to do it in the next few years or next couple of parliaments, so it's worth taking our time over it, certainly.
Yeah.
And there were things that the ISC recommended that were good. You had a look at the report.
Yeah, so they particularly pointed out the fact that none of this, you know, they found out that, yes, there is bulk surveillance happening, but that GCHQ just hasn't been open and transparent enough about it. And, you know, it criticised how opaque the law is and, you know, how difficult it is for people to understand what's happening to their data and what the agency is doing. And for the first time, it, you know, publicly stated a lot of the capabilities that GCHQ has that we, you know, we've long suspected and said, yes, this is happening. It's not necessarily a bad thing, which, you know, is a separate question altogether, but it people should know about it. It should be transparent and it should be open. And it actually suggested that we kind of scrap all current intelligence laws that govern the intelligence agencies and pass a single act of parliament that gathers all of this legislation together, states it very clearly and openly. And, you know, it's difficult because in one respect, yes, that would be good, because we do want to know what happens and we do deserve that knowledge. But in another respect, it's just saying, yes, this, now we all know about it. Bulk surveillance is happening. Deal with it. We're going to make it open and in law now.
But on the other hand, if you're having one specific act built for this, and this is going to be, you know, this is now built for purpose, not using old laws that were completely irrelevant, then surely that's a good thing. Also, in the respect that, you know, James has spoken to GCHQ and they're pointing to, you know, acts and laws that seem very vague and we're not really sure how they apply them.
And so that were drawn up a very long time ago.
Yeah,
as well.
So could this not be a great thing that it has a cohesive answer and real answers that actually put your fears?
It's progress. It's definitely progress.
But in another sense, you know, it could be, we've talked a lot about the kind of snooper's charter and that kind of thing this year. And it's likely that a lot of the laws that we've been concerned about that the government have been trying to pass will be also entrenched in this new Act of Parliament. So that's concerning in one sense. But, you know, it's a difficult one to call.
And I think so much of what people balk at, you know, bulk surveillance and a lot of Snowden's revelations, they seem so shocking. But really, I think a lot of people, not really that surprised. We kind of assume a lot of these things are going on. But the fact that it's all coming out from someone who is an average Joe who's come out and told us all, it's taken that to happen. That makes it more shocking and it makes us angry and it makes us want answers and we want oversight and we're, is this right? Is this legal? How is this going to continue? But I think actually if it was explained to people, if there was time taken to explain what's necessary, why, when, how, where, and what checks and balances are in place, then I think actually a lot of people might say, you know, with my sense of privacy and selfhood, I would be against bulk surveillance. But actually, as a person and someone living in the modern world, you might start to agree that yes, we need bulk surveillance in some circumstances. But if it was explained to us, we would be much happier about it.
Yes, and if there was oversight. So some of the reasons that they give them for there not being oversight of specific operations is that it would slow things down, that the bureaucracy would get in the way. And while there's, you know, all of this stigma against red tape and silly rules and regulations, with this sort of stuff, it is important. You wouldn't want the police to be operating without very, very strict guidelines, and you wouldn't be wanting your security services to be operating without them either.
But the police does have specific kind of instances of getting emergency warrants when you can't wait, you know, if you have information that you have to act on. And security services and spy agencies are going to be dealing with a heck of a lot of situations where you have to react now, you have to make decisions now, and you have to justify it later, which to us, like, sounds awful, but to a certain extent I can see why, you know, they don't want to be slowed down, which is why if you did have good laws in place and good oversights, you know, then you can trust that people can go ahead and act in the correct way because they're working within a secure framework.
Yeah, so let's look at where it's going to go next. So the draft code, the consultation for the draft code that GCHQ is operating under at the moment, the consultation for that closes on Friday. We're then going to have a whole new round of debate. We're also waiting for the security services response to the ISC report, the government to sit down and have a think about the report as well. So there's going to be an awful lot more to come out of this over the coming months and years, and it will probably get shunted aside a bit for the election, and then it will all kick off again after that.
Well, I think food for thought, guys.
Yeah.
You're going to be mulling this. We're going to be talking about this, I'm sure, extensively in the run-up to the election and what various parties say when it comes to security and privacy laws.
But it's good to be starting from a position of knowledge rather than one of, well, they might be doing this, but we don't really know how they're doing it.
Of course.
Or why, or what their justification is for how they're acting.
At least we know now.
We've got more of an idea.
Well, here's hoping. Here's hoping that next week we'll magically be able to come on the podcast and give you all the answers. I will live in that dream. Well, there's no feedback this week, I'm afraid, but please, if you are interested in all the topics, some of the topics we talked about, please write into podcast@wired.co.uk and we will read out your lovely words next week. That's all for us for now, but I should flag up, actually, you haven't got long until Wired Health, our first big event of the year on April 24th, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, I've just found out that I will be able to attend. I thought I wasn't going to be able to, and it was so good last year that I'm really, really relieved.
She was actually gutted. Katie was going to be on jury service.
Yes.
But she's not anymore, no. So I'm sure we're allowed to talk about it.
Yes.
There's lots of very inspiring speakers at Wired Health, so it's going to be my first one.
It's going to be fun.
Really excited.
Yeah,
for
it's
it.
Very fast-paced, but you're going to talk. You're going to basically listen to people that are healing the world.
Yeah, changing people's lives.
Yeah, really cool bionic prosthetics, amazing syringes that aren't going to spread disease anymore. Things like that that are going to change the planet. So quite
April
exciting.
24th.
April 24th. Yeah, put it in your diaries. But that's all for us this week. See you next week. Bye.
Bye.